Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what is not being discussed at the Nuclear Security Summit underway in Washington, and that is the vulnerability of American nuclear weapons in Europe, with 20 or so B-61 nuclear bombs about 60 miles from Brussels sitting in bunkers at a base that already a Tunisian-born terrorist tried to blow up in 2003. William Arkin, the author of Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, who was a national security consultant to the NBC News Investigative Unit and Vice News, where he has an article, America's Nuclear Weapons in Europe Are the Nuclear Elephant in the Room, joins us. Then, with the warning by the Secretary of Treasury that while sanctions over the past decade have become the smart power of U.S. foreign policy because they are cheaper and more effective in compelling America's adversaries than military power, there is a risk of overuse. James Henry, who is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University and a Senior Fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, joins us to discuss the tools that the U.S. Treasury has in going after the hidden wealth and offshore funds of dictators, kleptocrats, and rogue states to alter their behavior, short of going to war, that usually results in the victims of tyranny being punished while the despots are often rewarded and their power consolidated. Then finally, we will follow up on Donald Trump's remarks on punishing women who have had abortions and the backlash from the pro-life community, whose outrage appears highly hypocritical, since if abortion were to be outlawed, as most Republicans fervently wish, then surely both doctors and patients will be criminalized. Zoe Carpenter, The Nation magazine's associate Washington editor, joins us to discuss her article at The Nation, Women Are Already Punished for Trying to End Their Pregnancies, and the extent to which anti-choice groups have pushed women into a legal gray zone where fetal homicide laws are used to punish women for abortions and even miscarriages. And joining us now is William Arkin, who's a national security consultant to Vice News and the NBC News Investigative Unit. He's one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He's written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés at the Washington Post. He conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America Investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book is Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, and he has an article at Vice News, America's Nuclear Weapons in Europe Are the Nuclear Elephant in the Room. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And with the president now hosting about 47 heads of state, with the conspicuous absence of Vladimir Putin, it's his fourth and last nuclear security summit in terms of nuclear weapons and their proliferation, both of the weapons and of the fissile material. And here you are telling us that right in this very country where we've just had the most hideous terrorist attack and some very troubling developments with a security guard at a Belgium nuclear facility being murdered only a few days ago and his security pass being taken, the surveillance footage of some of the people involved in the terrorist attacks of a nuclear scientist and his family, etc. Well, tell us about the nuclear elephant in the room in Belgium.
Well, it struck me as soon as the nuclear story started to be connected to the attacks at Belgium airport and the train station that it was ironic that people were talking about the vulnerability of Belgian nuclear facilities and not even recognizing that less than 60 miles from the Belgian International Airport is a stockpile of American nuclear bombs, which have been there since the 1960s and continue to be there as part of what I can only say is a completely obsolete and stagnated NATO nuclear system.
And these are gravity bombs that are meant to be carried by F-16s, right?
Correct. So the United States, at the height of the Cold War, had 7,000 nuclear weapons stored in Europe at about 700-plus facilities. And and basically in the early days of NATO, in order to be one of the big boys in NATO, to be one of the full participants in NATO, a system was created whereby non-U.S. nations could involve themselves in the nuclear deterrent by virtue of signing up to have their weapon systems and their units certified to actually carry American nuclear weapons. And this included Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, Greece, and Turkey. And so as U.S. nuclear weapons were deployed, they were also deployed at the host bases, the national bases of these countries. And the national base in Belgium is a place called Klein Brogel. It's in Flanders. And they've been there ever since. And of course, the number has dramatically declined. The best estimate today is there's about 20 nuclear bombs there. But they're constantly being upgraded and constantly being tinkered with. So these are not bombs from the 1960s. They're the newest bombs in the U.S. nuclear arsenal. And they are indeed slated for Belgian pilots to fly in Belgian F-16s to wherever their intended targets are during a nuclear war with Russia. And the process of getting rid of these weapons, the process of ridding Europe of these weapons has been stagnant for more than a decade now, because there's a reluctance on the part of the European nations, the militaries of the European nations who are involved in this nuclear business, to get out of it. And their fear, and it's an interesting sort of conundrum, is that if they're not involved in the nuclear deterrent in NATO, if they're not really directly involved, meaning if they don't have some decision-making authority over the use of nuclear weapons, then the fear is that the United States would be able to make a unilateral decision to use nuclear weapons in Europe without the consent of the countries that are going to be most affected. And so the irony of today's nuclear arsenal in Europe, we estimate that there's about 150 or so bombs spread out over five countries now: Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, Turkey, and Germany, is that all of those weapons, or most of those weapons, but I think now probably all of them, are actually earmarked for delivery by those host nations' forces. They're not earmarked for delivery by the United States. The weapons that might be delivered by the United States are actually stored inside the United States. So those last vestiges of the Cold War, those last nuclear weapons on European soil, are there as a kind of, I don't know what you could call it, a tax or an insurance policy on the part of the European governments to have some influence over the United States making a decision to use nuclear weapons, because the fear would be that if they weren't on European soil, they would not have any say.
And again, I'm speaking with William Arkin, who is a national security consultant to Vice News and NBC News Investigative Unit. He is the author of American Coup, and his latest book is Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. And he has an article at Vice News, American Nuclear Weapons in Europe, Are the Nuclear Elephant in the Room? So first of all, I'm not sure what the range of a F-16 fighter is. It's hard to believe that one could actually even reach Russia, or if the Russians had invaded all the way through Europe, perhaps they could do something with those weapons, but that's highly unlikely. But in your article, you mentioned there's a special American unit, the 130-person strong 701st Munitions Support Squadron, the majority of whom are Air Force Security Police, maintain 11 vaults at Kleinbrogel. And these are the vaults where the bombs are kept, right?
That's correct. So over the years, the United States has spent billions of dollars improving the security of these few nuclear weapons that are left on European soil. So in fact, the opinion of virtually everyone is, well, they're not vulnerable because they're in underground vaults, inside protective shelters, inside restricted areas, inside military bases with so many levels of security and even, as I said, dedicated security people, 300 Americans and Belgians who do nothing but secure the nuclear weapons, that there's this sort of laissez-faire attitude that that they're not a danger in terms of terrorists taking possession of them. And of course, you're exactly right, Ian, in pointing out that there really would be very little likelihood that an F-16 taking off from Kleinbrogel will be able to reach Russia or to reach any target inside Russia. So the stationing of these nuclear weapons is purely a symbolic gesture. But now we have to ask, in this age of terrorism, whether or not the price is worth paying, because it's not just Belgium. I mean, the nuclear weapons are stored in southern Turkey, less than 300 miles from the headquarters of ISIS, less than 300 miles from Raqqa, Syria. And Turkey is a country that is quickly imploding politically. And yet where you know, it's not safe enough for U.S. dependents and families to remain on Turkish soil. They were ordered to evacuate this week, and yet we have nuclear weapons there. And so
By the way, are you talking about Incirlik, the NATO base?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, that's
yes.
That's actually closer, I think, than 300 miles.
Well, it's 300 miles to Raqqa,
right,
to the capital.
Yeah.
Less than a couple of hundred miles to the border.
Right.
But in the case of Turkey, I would be just as much concerned that that the Turkish military would implode as I would some outside threat. And so we have this kind of irony here, that people talk about North Korea as the most dangerous and volatile country in the world with its own nuclear weapons, and yet the United States withdrew its nuclear weapons from South Korea in 1991-1992 because their presence in South Korea was considered to be too provocative and too insecure, and yet we still have nuclear weapons in Europe and serving this sort of political solidarity, symbolic role, and yet the places where they are stored, which have always been sort of just assumed to be safe, are now shown to be indeed quite unsafe.
Well, it's a little known fact that already NATO nuclear weapons fell into the wrong hands. That during the Turkish invasion of Cyprus some years back, a British NATO airbase was overrun by Turkish troops, and there were bunkers there with nuclear weapons in them. Now, fortunately, nobody knew that there were nukes in there, and the Brits were able to take them out. But there's already an historical example of them essentially falling out of the hands of NATO. And as you say, Bill Arkin, that there is this special detachment of American Air Force security police guarding the bombs in this airbase in Belgium, they would have the same morale, I would imagine, as all of those Air Force officers sitting under the prairies of the Midwest. We've had tremendous problems with the morale of the people with the strategic nuclear weapons. around the clock. So isn't it reasonable to assume that if you think you've got this worthless mission or this mission that's a mission to nowhere, your morale's not going to be good and therefore your attention is not going to be good?
Well, it's a point, Ian, but I don't think that it's the primary point. I mean, look, it's a lot better if you're a young Air Force guy to be stationed in the Netherlands or Belgium than it is to be stationed in North Dakota, with no insult meant to the people of North Dakota. But they're really out in the middle of nowhere in places like North Dakota and Montana. And so I don't think it's necessarily considered a bad assignment per se. And when you're doing security, I don't think really you spend a lot of time and energy thinking about what you're securing. Your job is to secure it. I think that the issue here is more that we really don't know anymore what constitutes effective security, whether it be an airplane flying into the Pentagon or a suicide bomber walking up to the gate of some military base. We just don't know. And we can't just continue to spend more and more tens and hundreds of millions of dollars improving security. Now, as a result of the Brussels attacks, we'll see more money being spent on improving security, I'm sure, without asking the question, well, why are they there anymore in the first place? If we can remove them from North Korea and from South Korea and still have an effective deterrent against North Korea, then certainly we can remove them from Europe. Because they're really serving no useful political and zero military role. So the issue is I would think, and I would hope, beyond the question of security, that security has sort of always been the way in which the military and NATO authorities have slipped away from the question of what the nuclear weapons are actually doing there by saying, well, we spent a lot of money on their physical security. And so, therefore, because they are safe from being captured or being taken, that there's no political or policy issues associated with their presence there. I could imagine, I really could, that terrorists who were able to penetrate just even into the base or into a nuclear plant and holding that base and plant hostage with the threat of blowing it up, it would be sufficient. They don't even need to actually get to the nuclear weapons or the nuclear materials. This would be a cataclysmic event if this ever happened. And so it seems to me that we need to look beyond the security questions, beyond the issue of NATO solidarity, and rationalize our system for the 21st century and get these weapons out of Europe, which is what we should have done in 1991-92.
But already, as your article points out, William Arkin, a Tunisian-born national was sentenced to 10 years in prison for plotting to bomb Klein Brogel base, where these U.S. nuclear weapons are, in 2003. So, yes. You know, already there's a red flag already. I mean,
well, there have been a number of post 9/11 incidents associated with U.S. nuclear bases in Europe. There was another. A rumored case in Italy, and there have certainly been occasions in Turkey when there has been high alert as a result of unrest in Turkey and as a result of now the ISIS war. So ironically, when I talked to NATO officials this week about nuclear security, they were all reassuring, oh, we're finishing our latest round of upgrades of this and that with this gizmo and that gizmo and this higher fence and that a deeper vault, and they were completely, it was just lost on them that program, that is the current cycle, if you will, began before the ISIS campaign began. So it wasn't even intended to counter ISIS or the growth of ISIS related terrorism in Europe. And so now, you know, what we'll see is we'll see the predictable cycle unfold once again of another round of security upgrades. And really the most logical outcome here is to just remove all the nuclear weapons. And And the excuse of physical security being sufficient or insufficient should no longer be the impediment. And I find it just ironic that here's the United States making all sorts of rhetorical statements about the need to secure nuclear materials and nuclear weapons all around the world. And yet we just had, as you said, this crazy, unexpected terrorist attack in Belgium, the capital of NATO, where the headquarters of NATO is, less than 100 miles from where nuclear weapons are stored. And it has not even been mentioned by one news outlet until today.
Well, just in closing, William Arkin, do you think that any of what we're talking about is being discussed at the Nuclear Security Summit that began today, Thursday, in Washington, D.C., hosted by President Obama? Do you think that they're addressing this obvious invitation to terrorism? I mean, it's not as if, I mean, this is a double-barreled piece of boneheadedness. One, the weapons themselves don't seem to be of much military utility. I think we've established that. And two, these are the ultimate gifts to terrorists, and the terrorists have just operated within miles of this place. And back in 2003, one of them tried to get into it and blow it up. So I would say in the real world, that ought to be a priority.
Well, I would agree with you. And I'm sure that it's not going to be discussed because the Obama administration is closing out a four-session set of feel-good summits about nuclear security where they don't want to put themselves in the spotlight. And, of course, the greatest impediment towards additional reductions and treaties relating to non-strategic nuclear weapons is that Russia, of course, has demanded that the United States withdraw its nuclear weapons from Europe, another complication, and they're not even present. So I don't see anything happening this year, and I certainly haven't really felt that the Obama administration has been interested in taking on the bureaucracy and sort of dealing with this nuclear problem. So this is going to persist into the next administration, and I think that as we continue to see these kinds of attacks taking place in unexpected places in Europe, and it's going to have to be addressed. And the easiest way to address it, and it really is an easy way, because they serve no military or political purpose anymore that has to do with the defense of Western Europe, is to remove them.
Well, William Arkin, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with William Arkin, who's a national security consultant to Vice News and NBC News Investigative Unit. He is one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War, and he has written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés at the Washington Post. He conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book is Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, and he has an article at Vice News, America's Nuclear Weapons in Europe Are the Nuclear Elephant in the Room. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Secretary of Treasury's warning that there is a risk of sanctions being overused.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is a senior economist at the Tax Justice Network and a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And the Treasury Secretary spoke yesterday at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and while he talked about how in the last decade the use of sanctions have become something of a silver bullet, if not an example of smart power in compelling advocacies in a more effective and cheaper way than traditional military power, he did, Jack Lew did warn of the risks of overuse. But let's talk about what can be done through the Treasury Department as opposed to through the Pentagon, because I've heard from national security people I've talked to on and off the record who say that, you know, at the ultimate piece of power in the American president's hands is the sort of red letter from the Treasury Department that essentially shuts down a country's ability to trade on the international markets.
Well, I think that's true. The issue is to what extent are these kinds of sanctions effective. I mean, we've just come off 50 years of sanctions against Cuba, which were probably the most far-reaching ever imposed per capita, and they basically backfired. You know, so the kind of collective punishment of a whole population for the sins of its leaders is clearly not very effective. We had sanctions in place against North Korea, against Syria since 2004, against Belarus since 2004, Zimbabwe since 2003. None of these have done anything but strengthen the existing regimes. And, you know, there's also been sanctions against Iran. I think one of Lew's key points was that we have to be willing when we put sanctions on to remove them when they work or when they when the targets comply. And that's been an issue with the Congress. The real news in his announcement, his speech yesterday, was this call for removing sanctions, which tend to, you know, once they're adopted, outlive their usefulness or stick, you know, they're very hard to repeal. And I think he was referring there to the threat that Congress has made to keep the sanctions on Iran despite the progress they've made on the nuclear deal. So, you know, that was the real, from my standpoint, the real innovation that in Lew's position was this recognition that, you know, sanctions for whatever, we could debate whether in what situations they've been effective. But certainly they're not going to be effective if once they're in place, the parties that were targeted have complied with our requests and then the sanctions aren't removed.
So short of the fact that Jack Lew was signaling to the Congress over, they were against the Iran deal all along, and you recall the Prime Minister of Israel even addressed the Congress without informing the president to try and stop it. And it's been obviously a huge political football and something of an obsession. And it doesn't make sense in any way that once people comply, that you continue punishing them.
Right.
But in terms of the actual, and of course, the Secretary of Treasury did say that the Iranian sanctions are the model that he's talking about, because there was obviously lots of calls or lots of suspicions and lots of fears that there would be a military attack on Iran. Apparently Dick Cheney wanted to have one, Netanyahu wanted to have one, and but for the sanctions, we may have had a massive mess on our hands.
Well, I think that's right. I think what you have in the case of Iran is interesting because it's precisely because they're a semi-democratic society. I mean, they have the theocracy still in place, but they had elections, you know, last month, and they've been basically, moving in the direction of a more, somewhat slightly more liberal regime. And they were also, I think responding to the pressures of the masses for, economic improvement. And so for the United States, right now for the Congress to insist that we continue these sanctions, even though the bargain that we made with them implied that we would relax sanctions and they would get some economic benefit, is really unfair to that that sort of democratic movement. It's the hard cases like North Korea and Cuba and even Zimbabwe. These are the cases where sanctions basically tend to reinforce existing dictatorships. But in the case of Iran, we've had fairly effective targeted sanctions that were able to, apply some economic pressure. So it's a real case-by-case basis, but I don't think the overall track record of sanctions has been all that strong. And the most effective sanctions have been financial sanctions. Back in the 80s, we had South Africa's sanctions against a variety of sanctions applied to South Africa. The most effective by far were the bank sanctions that basically cut off South Africa's apartheid regime's access to international capital markets. Far less effective are sanctions like the ones that apply to South African academics, where you're actually effectively penalizing the more progressive elements of the society. So it's a really nuanced subject, but I'm glad to see that Lou is recognizing that we need to keep our end of the bargain.
Well, you mentioned North Korea, and of course the UN just announced a whole new round of sanctions against North Korea, and this time apparently China is actually starting to cooperate. They've cut the import of coal, which was one of the main sources of revenue. And now the North Korean dictator has warned his people that they're going to have to eat roots and leaves. So he's preparing them for a famine, I think.
Well, that's another case here where sanctions really are more effective if you have international solidarity on part of all the trading partners. And in Korea, for many years, China refused to kind of go along with the harder, sort of sanctions against North Korea. And maybe this time around things will be different. But, certainly the most effective sanctions that we've seen politically were those against South Africa, which were joined by more than 130 countries. And even they took quite a bit of time to work. So I think, Lou is right that sanctions are preferable in some cases to military action. And that it's, best to target them. They're most effective if we target using financial sanctions in particular. His real point to Congress was we have to keep our end of the bargain with Iran.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, who is a former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's a senior economic advisor to the Tax Justice Network and a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment. So my understanding is in terms of the sanctions against Russia, starting with Crimea, and then they were amped up when Russia shot down the Malaysian airliner. And then that's when Obama went after Putin's cronies and his bankers and people like that. And apparently that is pretty effective. So, but the ultimate sanction, though, isn't in terms of financial sanctions through the Treasury. And again, the notion that Treasury has more power in a curious way in this new global environment than the Pentagon. The ultimate, the red letter, is that cutting a country off from the SWIFT system of international banking transactions?
Well, the SWIFT system basically facilitates international trade. Russia has been trying to design ways around it, inventing their own SWIFT systems and increasing their trade, their cooperation in this area with China. I think the sanctions against Russia have been a mixed bag, frankly, in terms of actually producing changes in Putin's behavior. I mean, he's still in the Crimea. He has, been pretty active in Syria, as we've seen. The problem there is that we have European allies who have a lot of trade at stake with Russia and with the Ukraine is in miserable condition economically, so it's not clear that we wouldn't be hurting the Ukraine even more than we're hurting Russia by increasing the sanctions. So a lot of the I think that the sanctions against Russia have been the leaky weapon so far. But, they've definitely had it's also not easy to separate the impact of the oil price decline from the sanctions. You know, Russia was also severely hurt by that. So all in all, I don't see much change, evidence that Putin's behavior has become less aggressive, if anything, the opposite.
Well, the press secretary for Putin, Dmitry Peskov, his spokesperson, just on Monday railed against the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who are apparently looking into Putin's personal wealth and information about his family and childhood and his business allies, including Yuri Kovalchuk and Arkady Rutenberg, the bankers who are sanctioned by Obama. Mm-hmm. I think you've done some work, haven't you, for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists? Do you know what they're working on?
Yes, I'm familiar with them, but they are colleagues in the investigative international area. There's a handful of journalists out there who are really doing work on these kinds of hidden offshore accounts, and it's laborious and a little bit dangerous. Tracking Putin's offshore accounts hasn't been very successful. We know that many of his business cronies have, companies in Switzerland. I mean, most of the companies heavily involved in trading Russian oil are based not in Cyprus or in Moscow, but in Zurich. So that's a good place to look. But again, I think, you can go after some of the cronies around Putin and try to make it more difficult for them to travel and, have offshore accounts. At some point, I think it comes back to, is Putin actually changing policy in response to this stuff? I mean, compared with the sanctions we've applied against, other countries, I think the Russian sanctions are a little bit more permeable because of the European connections.
So my understanding is, though, that the Treasury did really put the squeeze on Milosevic during the Yugoslav War. Milosevic was the last central banker of the state of Yugoslavia before it broke up, and he apparently parked all of the central bank's money in Cyprus, and it sort of became indistinguishable from his own. And I believe that the U.S. really did some stuff to him. I mean, can they literally disappear money, either from dictators, drug dealers, or whatever?
Well, we have this case of the Banco Delta Asia, in the case of a Macau bank that was dealing heavily with North Korea. And we were able to go after them, basically almost shut down the bank and make economic trading temporarily, at least, much more difficult for North Korea. There's some evidence that they came to the bargaining table with respect to nuclear power back in the 90s, at least temporarily. Our capacity to know all about money movements around the world is pretty extraordinary. The actual evidence of how many of these tough regimes have had their policies changed by these various kinds of sanctions is limited. I mean, I think it really works best when you have a global community that's really targeting and working together, as in the case of South Africa, and in the case of North Korea now. I think this is a different case, but it's definitely not the case with Russia. It wasn't the case with Cuba. We had Europeans investing heavily in Cuba throughout the embargo period. So we have permeable sanctions. Mm-hmm. And the lack of international cooperation, you're less likely to have sanctions work.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're quite welcome. Yes, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's a senior economic advisor to the Tax Justice Network and a global justice fellow at Yale University and a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Investment. We can take a brief station break and be back looking into how women are already being punished for trying to end their pregnancies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Zoe Carpenter, the Nation Magazine's Associate Washington Editor, who worked previously for Rolling Stone and has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, and other media outlets. Her latest article at The Nation is, Women Are Already Punished for Trying to End Their Pregnancies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zoe Carpenter.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously these remarks by Donald Trump on punishing women who have abortions, which he quickly revised, they elicited a lot of outrage from the pro-life community, but it strikes me as being the height of hypocrisy, because if you outlaw abortion, as the Republicans fervently want to do, surely you will criminalize both doctors and patients.
Well, one would certainly think so, but the anti-abortion movement has been very careful in the past couple of decades to advance a public relations message in which they describe women as victims and abortion providers as the enemy or the people that we should be criminalizing if abortion were to be outlawed. And, you know, that's a very clear response to the terrible publicity they were getting in the 80s and 90s when the movement became very violent. And so this was a strategy developed to make them seem like they had women's best interests at heart. And so that's why we saw such a quick reaction to Trump's comments from his rivals and from other members of the anti-choice movement.
But I'm surprised that anybody buys the notion that they do try to propagate with all of these endless attempts at both the federal and the state level to chip away at abortion rights, the latest of which, of course, is before the Supreme Court in the case of Texas, where they've arbitrarily created a high bar for abortion clinics to reach, knowing that they'll drive them out of business. But this is always done in the name of helping women. And I'm astounded that anybody can buy the idea that you're trying to help women by restricting their choice.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But the way that those types of restrictive laws are described, if they're done so lazily in the press or by the politicians who are trying to get them passed, is that they sound like pretty innocuous health and safety measures. You know, of course, we should have clinics that meet health and safety standards. The problem is that these regulations aren't medically necessary, and there's no reason, for example, for a clinic that only provides medication-based abortion, that is, by pill, to meet standards for a surgical center. So there are many layers of deceit that are happening here.
And in terms of there are, of course, countries like El Salvador and the Philippines that criminalize abortion and even criminalize miscarriage. People in El Salvador, for example, have been charged with inducing miscarriages and spent up to 30 years in jail in some cases. So there are examples, though, in this country, are there not, of not quite as draconian, but similar cases.
That's correct. Yeah, it's not just in El Salvador. Some of the cases that we know about are quite extreme. So, for example, in 1990, there was a teenager in Florida who couldn't afford an abortion, and she actually shot herself in the abdomen and was later charged with third-degree murder. But then more recently, there are cases such as a mother in Pennsylvania who ordered a medication that could cause an abortion over the Internet for her teenage daughter. And she was charged. And then a woman in Tennessee who tried to use a coat hanger recently to induce an abortion, and she actually gave birth to a live baby and was charged with attempted murder and then later assault. So what's happening is that these restrictive laws that are driving the clinics out of business are on a collision course with what are called fetal homicide laws, and those are the laws that criminalize women for trying to attempt an abortion on their own. And so as abortion becomes less and less available, while it is still technically legal, more women are seeking out these at-home options, which are criminalized.
And, of course, another case that you mention in your article at The Nation, Zoe Carpenter, is in 2009, a teenager in Utah paid a man $150 to beat her up, hoping it would cause a miscarriage, and she was charged with solicitation to commit murder. So I think, in a way, Trump has provided us all with an opportunity to get real about this. I mean, obviously, this is all a PR feint on the part of the pro-life lobby to make themselves seem touchy-feely, and they really care about women. Most of them seem to be men to begin with, and it's always very hard. I think it's kind of a moral free ride to care about something that involves somebody else for which you have no responsibility and will take no responsibility short of putting them in a situation where they have no choice but to have to deliver a child. So it's very odd that this country is the only one in the world that seems to be obsessed with this issue, not to suggest that El Salvador and the Philippines and others aren't even more draconian. But do you think that maybe all of this sort of dumping on Trump, which is easy to do because he's such an outrageous clown, perhaps is missing an opportunity here to call out the pro-lifers?
I think it is, because the anti-abortion movement has always been reluctant to address what the real repercussions would be if you did overturn Roe versus Wade. We have documentation going back to 1500 BC that women have been willing to risk imprisonment, pain, illness, and death in order to end pregnancies. And there's no reason to think that they would suddenly stop trying to get abortions if just because it was illegal. There's no evidence in the historical record to suggest that. And so these questions about what would be the impact on our criminal justice system, what would be the impact on our health system if we did give the anti-choice movement what it wanted and overturn Roe v. Wade, they don't like to talk about the implications because it's tremendously complicated and it looks very, very ugly. And then these kinds of questions, like the one that Trump brought up about who we actually prosecute, have to be answered. And the movement as a whole would prefer not to have to get into those specifics because, of course, then the actual reality of what they're proposing becomes clear.
And again, I'm speaking with Zoe Carpenter, who's the Nation magazine's associate Washington editor, who worked previously for Rolling Stone, and she has an article at The Nation, Women Are Already Punished for Trying to End Their Pregnancies. So in terms of the current laws, that it still seems extraordinary to me that you have Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court level, and yet you have all of these instances that we've talked about where women have been punished for trying to end pregnancies and been charged with murder. And I just mentioned the case of the young woman in Utah who paid somebody $150 to beat them up and then got charged with murder, or attempted murder. How do they get around that? I mean, obviously there's some latitude there in the law, and presumably at the end of the day, a 15-year-old girl in Utah doesn't have the resources to take the case to the Supreme Court, I take it.
Yeah, you know, the reason I think there haven't been too many of these cases that have been successfully turned into a prison term is because once the public outcry starts, it becomes so apparent that charging people for trying to take matters into their own hands is really not a proper carriage of justice. And I think, you know, these laws depend on the prosecutors. So it depends whether they choose to actually use fetal homicide laws in this way. You know, many states pass fetal homicide laws with the explicit intention to criminalize drunk drivers who killed pregnant women and their fetuses, things like that. But now it's being used in this really derivative fashion.
But I assume, again, the idea that you don't have the resources to challenge it, ultimately, because it is unconstitutional, this really impacts poor women.
It does really impact poor women, yes, that's true. They don't have the resources to challenge these cases. And in the first place, they're less likely to have the resources to be able to get a legal abortion. And so that's why they're turning to these self-abortion methods.
So in terms of this current presidential race, obviously this whole issue came out of an interview that Chris Matthews on MSNBC did with Donald Trump, a town hall meeting yesterday. And then, of course, he quickly had to revise and amend his remarks. But that didn't stop Ted Cruz and others from piling on, Kasich as well, who's pretty draconian himself, although Ted Cruz, I believe, is even more draconian in that he doesn't even give exceptions for the life of the mother and victims of rape and incest in his zeal to ban abortions, whereas I believe Kasich, even though he's something of an anti-abortion zealot himself, makes that exception. all I heard from Bernie Sanders was that he found the remarks disgusting. And I believe Hillary Clinton sort of got into the areas that we're talking about a little bit, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. You know, they both offered a condemnation of their remarks, which is not surprising. Hillary Clinton has been endorsed by the major reproductive rights groups, NARAL and Planned Parenthood Federation of America. So I'm not surprised that she offered such a strong condemnation of Trump's remarks. And that's definitely to her credit that, you know, she's no longer talking about abortion being legal, safe, and rare, but she's now just focusing on the legal and safe part of things.
But nobody's venturing into what we talked about a minute ago, which is using this as an opportunity to call out the hypocrisy amongst the pro-lifers who are trying to present an image of really caring about women's health when they want to impose their values on others.
Mm-hmm. That might be a little bit too complex for cable news.
Well, I mean, don't you think it resonates? I mean, what's your understanding of the polling? I always got the impression that the squeaky wheel, obviously, in our media gets the attention, and Donald Trump has taken that to a whole new level. But is there still a majority in this country that would perhaps, you know, they certainly, if they don't favor keeping Roe v. Wade, they certainly, if Roe v. Wade were overturned, they'd pretty quickly wake up to its consequences, wouldn't they?
Well, actually, the polling shows pretty decisively that the majority of Americans do support Roe v. Wade. What gets a lot more complicated is when you get into what our writer Katha Pollitt calls the muddled middle. So people who think that abortion should be legal but that there should be some restrictions. And so the question of how many restrictions on whom becomes a lot more complicated. But there's also been some interesting polling before Trump made these comments about the Republican Party, and that there's actually quite a sizable slice of the party that is moderate on social issues. They've effectively accepted the sexual revolution, and that includes being pro-choice to some extent. And so it seemed like when he was giving sort of a half defense of Planned Parenthood that maybe he was playing into he was tapping into that slice of the GOP, but clearly his comments yesterday represent his usual style, which is to say whatever comes to mind.
Well, my understanding is that about a third of abortions in this country are actually performed by using the pill. And there's just been a recent announcement by the FDA, I think, to make the pill more accessibly, the morning after pill, as it's called. And I think they've extended the time that it can be used to induce a miscarriage or an abortion. And my understanding is that even though that would seem on the surface to be, you know, helpful for women who are caught in this situation, I believe these pills are amazingly expensive. And again, it took so long for the morning after pill to be approved, and then it's gone through all of these challenges and finally apparently overcome the last challenge. But again, how can poor women afford this pill?
Well, first, we need to make a really clear distinction. The so-called abortion pill, Mifeprex, is very different from the morning after pill. Mm-hmm. The morning after pill does not cause an abortion. It's a contraceptive that prevents implantation. So the FDA's decision impacted the abortion pill, not the morning after pill. But you're correct. The abortion pill is expensive. It does still have to be administered by a doctor, and usually in a clinical setting. So some of the barriers will still be there, although the FDA's action was very significant yesterday.
And is there any other reason for why the pill is so expensive? Obviously, having to go to a facility with a doctor is expensive in itself. But I'm just trying to get a handle on whether this is, again, an effort to make it difficult for women to get abortions through literally costing a lot of money, or is this a case of Big Pharma just ripping people off?
Yeah, I don't think that the anti-abortion movement has much control over how the industry sets the price. I would have to look at the patents and things like that, but my guess would be that it would have more to do with lack of competition in the pharmaceutical markets.
I see. Well, just in closing then, Zoe Carpenter, short of this creating a debate, which I would certainly like to hear, and you've made it clear that you would like to hear, how do you think abortion politics are going to play out in this election?
Well, it's definitely going to be a huge issue because everyone in the GOP field is so extreme and so out of step with the actual lifestyle practices of the majority of American women and the majority of American men. So I think this is definitely not something we've heard the last of. And I think that abortion is really just the tip of the iceberg. That's what the anti-abortion movement likes to talk about because they can make it sound horrific and grisly. But then you get into these questions, well, if you're really anti-abortion, why don't you support comprehensive access to birth control and comprehensive sex education and things of that nature? So there's certainly more nuance that could be explored in this debate.
Yeah. I guess the question is, will it, given that already, as I say, it's a bit depressing to see both pro-choice and pro-life people weighing in against Donald Trump, but somewhat missing the point. I mean, it's a part of a broader question I would have just in closing, which is, if the Republicans are so terrified that Donald Trump is going to be their nominee, why then are the Democrats piling on? Shouldn't they basically want this guy to become the nominee? If the Republicans are so afraid that he's going to take them down, why not let it happen?
Well, you can't ever control all of the unknowns. There could be some kind of scandal. There could be, there could be external circumstances that make the election of a Republican candidate, regardless of who they are, more likely, such as an economic collapse or a major terrorist attack or something like that. So I think that just assuming that Trump can't get elected, it's not quite good enough.
I see. Well, I thank you for joining us, Zoe Carpenter.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Zoe Carpenter, who is the Nation Magazine's Associate Washington Editor, who worked previously for Rolling Stone, and she has an article at The Nation, Women Are Already Punished for Trying to End Their Pregnancies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.